This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm Paul Ingalls. If you're upset that there's not enough peace in the world, don't plan to complain to 1997 Nobel Peace Prize winner Jody Williams about it, unless you're ready to report to her that you're doing something yourself to help bring about change. As we'll hear today, Jody Williams has little patience for what she calls whiners. That's partly because since the early 1990s, the straight-talking Jody Williams has been all about walking the walk. She had been an English as second language teacher and an education and medical aid worker in the 1980s, but in 1992 she took on a leadership role with the newly formed International Campaign to Ban Landmines. The organization ultimately achieved its goal in 1997 when an international treaty banning anti-personal landmines was signed in Ottawa. To date, 155 countries have signed on. About 40 still have not, including the United States, China, Russia, Iran, Iraq, Israel, India, and Vietnam. As work continues on the landmines issue, now Williams is lending her support to campaigns to ban cluster bombs and nuclear weapons expansion. Today on Peace Talks Radio, you'll hear some of her comments made to the Building a Culture of Peace conference held in Santa Fe, New Mexico in May of 2007, and then later our host Carol Boss will talk one-on-one with Jody Williams.
I was in Hiroshima, and because I was with a crowd and I got anxious, I went out to walk around Hiroshima a little bit. And how many of you have been there? I don't know if it was the same for you, but when I walked through the area where the nuclear bomb had dropped, I really felt like you could feel the spirits of the people who were vaporized that morning there in the environment. And I walked away from the site of where we dropped Little Boy or whatever it was called, euphemistically, the damn nuclear bomb is what it was. And I went down into a shopping area. I try, not that I am a shopaholic, but I like to buy shawls. I like the fabric of shawls, and Japanese fabric is absolutely awesome. And I walked by this little shop, and in the window was this most magnificent cloth I'd seen, and it was a kimono, and it was a blue, a vivid blue that I can't describe, and chrysanthemums flowed down the arms, which went to the floor. It was spectacular, and the old woman who worked in there saw that I loved it, and she said something to me in Japanese, and I said something to her in English, and the next thing I knew, I was wearing the fabulous kimono. And I wondered how human beings could be so incredibly marvelous to work with silkworms and create these things of beauty. And it was so beautiful, I thought, gee, maybe I'll spring a few hundred. It cost $3,500. I made her take it off me immediately and went back to the place where we were speaking. There was an exhibit going on when we were there, and it was hand drawings by survivors of the bomb. And one I will never forget. It was a picture of a woman who was coming out of a building that was in flames because of the nuke. And her arms were out like this, but she wasn't wearing a kimono. What was hanging from her arms to the ground was her own skin, looking like the arms of a kimono. So when I think about that blue kimono in Hiroshima, I also think about human beings in humanity to human beings, and who the hell thinks they have the right to vaporize tens of thousands of civilians in the name of peace, in the name of stopping war? And we don't even realize that the United States firebombed many, many, many Japanese cities, killing more than they did with the two nukes. We targeted civilians in war. And that didn't have anything to do with stopping Hitler in Europe. And until we accept the unpleasant parts of our history, we cannot change it. Until we stop pretending that the war would never have ended unless the heroic bomb was dropped, until we accept the fact that two bombs were dropped, and they were two different kinds of bombs, what does that say to anybody who's logical? They were testing which one worked better. And in fact, from what I understand, the one they continued to produce was the second one that dropped on Nagasaki because it is more efficient and effective. Although the ones we have now are much more efficient and effective, if you can call the possibility of vaporizing people efficient and effective, I can't. I believe it is possible to change that. But it will never be possible to change it unless we stop thinking that nukes are something out there that only nuclear physicists can possibly understand. That we don't really have to worry about it because the government, hello, and the experts are protecting us from the possibility of nuclear failure. I'm sorry, the people I know in government? They're protecting me from a weapon I don't even believe should exist? And I'm sitting back like an idiot and accepting that? Do you accept? This is a question we have to ask ourselves as activists. Do I accept that true security is provided to me individually or us as global citizens by allowing these governments, most of whom don't even reflect what we really think, do what they believe is right to defend us? National security. Right? Each government gets to buy all the weapons it wants or sell all the weapons it wants to their allies, who often then 10 or so years down the road end up being their enemies and use the weapons against them, but we won't think about that either because, God, it takes too much thought to connect the dots. If we really want to change the way this world thinks, if we really want to create a culture of peace, we have to say no more weapons of war in my name. I don't need nukes to defend me, thank you very much. I want a security system that gives everybody the rights that I have. When all of those dollars are used to meet the needs of the people that these governments are supposedly empowered to meet the needs of, that gives them opportunity for a future that makes them want to live that future. If I've got nothing, and I know that your country might attack me for trumped-up reasons, and I have been oppressed for generations because of some of the policies of your country, why wouldn't I strap a bomb on myself and go blow you up? That's not an illogical response. It may be an unpleasant response. It is a crime. But it is not an irrational response from a total population bereft of hope. Until we really treat the nations of the world relatively equally, and we're not going to be, you know, crazed and believe that a country with the economy of the United States is going to be the same as Vanuatu. Obviously, there are differences, but that does not mean that the only country in the world that matters is this one, or China, or Russia, because they're the big ones. I want people in Darfur to have the right to live the life they've been living for generations if that's the life they want to live. Have their homes, have their cattle, have their camels, have schooling, basic education, basic health care, a sharing of the resources in that country, because of course Khartoum takes all the oil resources for the cabal that runs that government since the 89 coup. I believe if the people of the Middle East have that, if the people of sub-Saharan Africa have that, if the people of Asia have that, we begin to build a culture that is different. We build a culture based on human security, not nuclear security, not national security. I think we also have to demystify the belief that peace is some wimpy utopian dream. It really pisses me off. I'm sorry. You know, for some, peace is inner peace. For me, peace is hard work every single day. When we as citizens speak up, when governments do things in our name that we do not agree with, you know, the overwhelming majority in this country does not agree with nukes. How come these idiots are wanting to build new nukes? What is wrong with this picture? You know, enough intellectualizing about the nukes. Something happened between the big marches in the 70s and now. You know, we'd get lots of newsletters about how evil nukes are. That's terrific. You need to go and tell Congress you do not want them to authorize new nukes. They are right now having hearings on the new nukes. If we don't say, get rid of the damn new nukes and get rid of the old nukes, they are going to make new nukes. It's a huge industry, guys. It's a huge industry. When we did the landmine campaign, you know, people would ask me, how did you do it? I mean, you know, didn't the military-industrial complex? I said, good God. Landmines gave most of the military industry about $200 million a year. Chump change. Billions and billions and billions fuel the nuclear industry. As many of you know better than I, GE, that brings good things to life, also gives us nukes. Let's wake up and smell the coffee, as they say. If we can't vote good people into office, we can vote with our money. Pay attention to who you are supporting. Don't buy GE. I won't buy GE. Take your money out of Fidelity if you have investments in Fidelity. If your state invests its pension funds in Fidelity, take it out. Look at where your money is going. If you can't make these idiots carry out policies that really do what you want them to do to contribute to a different world, take your money and move it somewhere else.
This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. You're listening to Jody Williams, the 1997 Nobel Peace Prize laureate, speaking to the Building a Culture of Peace conference held in Santa Fe, New Mexico in May of 2007. And now, Carol Boss's conversation with Jody Williams.
Peace is not just the absence of war, armed conflict. That is sort of a precondition for what would create, you know, stability and global security. After all, peace is really about if our basic needs are met and we're secure. That's what peace is to me. Caring about the basic needs of everybody, not just wanting for myself. And that's what I tell the kids. I also tell them that if they just whine at me about something that bothers them, whether it's the environment or gender equality or whatever it is, and when I ask them, okay, I understand your concern, but what are you going to do about it? And they can't answer me. I tell them to, you know, until they figure out action, don't waste my time with whining. You know, don't waste your energy. Go have a beer and watch a football game or whatever it is you like to do.
So in a way, it's demystifying what peace is.
Mm-hmm. Peace is not wimpy. I think we have to, you know, like, seize on what peace really is. Peace isn't wimpy. Peace is hot. Peace is sexy. Peace is hard work. There are a lot of cool, wonderful, hardworking people who work for a better world. Maybe we need to change the word, you know. I think it's been subverted by the warmongers.
I know you work with Peace Jam, which is mm-hmm. the international education program, and it's built around Nobel Peace Laureates mm-hmm. like yourself to inspire a new generation, essentially, of peacemakers. Mm-hmm. So I would like to ask you, in terms of inspiration for yourself, do you have a really good inspiration story in terms of you being inspired?
Well, I don't know if it's a good one. I have a story. You know, I have a couple of things. When we were little, my sister Mary Beth, who's only about a year and a half younger than I am, and I think she's really my twin, who came out of the womb a little later because she sleeps late and I get up early. But when we were little, Mumu used to say, you know, if you could be anyone in the world, who would you want to be? Thinking, of course, you'd want to be Marilyn Monroe or somebody like that. And I only always wanted to be myself. So I think it is such a struggle to be the best you can be. Why would you ever waste your energy trying to imagine being somebody else? And that has really kind of been, I guess, some sort of basic philosophy I have. I admire people who do good work, but I think I'm more inspired by those that nobody knows. Mm-hmm. The people who just amaze me the most are those who have very little and yet who dedicate their free time to the issues, you know, that I've worked on. There's one woman from Armenia. She's of indeterminate age. You know, she could be 50, she could be 75. It's really hard to tell. And when I first met Gemma, and she only speaks Armenian and Russian, when I first met Gemma, she had this phenomenal dyed black shellac beehive hairdo. So her name for me is always Gemma the Beehive. And then, after she came out into the world, she saw different modern hairdos. And suddenly I saw her, and her hair had been all cut and bouffanted. And I said, what happened to the beehive, you know, through translation? And she said, I decided I had to, you know, get hot for my husband, which I just thought was hilarious. So she's human. But there was a meeting of regional landmine campaigns, because when we have big campaign meetings, sometimes we'll break down into, you know, regions so they can plan together how they can advance the issue in the whole region. And the former Soviet states were meeting, and they all squabble in Russian, and they're quite hilarious and very vibrant. But at this particular meeting, there was a new young man who had come from Abkhazia, and he was asking for help from the others in the regional groups because he had nothing. And Gemma was the first one to speak up, and she said, you know, I'm very lucky. I'm a university professor. I have some resources. I can contribute resources to, you know, help you get started. And then they all started talking about other things that they could do to help this guy. And later, I saw her again, and I went over and I said, Gemma, in my, you know, phenomenal ignorance, I have no idea what the salary is of a professor in Armenia. What do you earn? She earns the equivalent of $100 US a month, and yet felt privileged that she had this income, felt affluent in a way, enough that she could donate money to help another landmine campaigner. Gemma the Beehive inspires me. Mm-hmm. You know, I love Archbishop Tutu. He's a wonderful friend. You know, the Nobel women that I work with are fabulous. But, you know, the Gemmas of the world are really amaze me that they keep working when they don't get all that recognition and hoopla.
So I read in an interview, I think somewhere online, about where you were talking about accepting responsibility of rethinking how we address the world's problems. And if we go to the formation, if we start talking about the formation of the international campaign to ban mm-hmm. landmines, from humble roots, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. A whole movement was born. Where did that rethinking emerge from?
I mean, in a sense, we're held up as some sort of quintessential model of government-civil-society partnership bringing about change, demonstrating that transnational civil society, you know, people across borders, can come together, work collectively with governments to address the problems that face us all. And yes, we have been tremendously successful, and we're a good model. But I was given a book relatively recently, and it's called Bury the Chains. Have you ever read it?
No.
Adam Hochschild. He was actually one of the founders of Mother Jones.
Yes.
He also wrote King Leopold's Ghost, which I haven't read yet, but I have to. And Bury the Chains talks about one of the first recorded civil society movements, and it was to end the slave trade in the UK. And in the introduction, they talk about, you know, that campaign, back before the U.S. Civil War, used many of the same techniques that we use today. It just wasn't, you know, with the technology we have today. And to me, that was phenomenally inspiring, actually, to think about myself and the campaign to ban landmines and now the campaign to ban cluster bombs, and we need a campaign to ban nukes. We're part of a chain.
What would be an example of a technique that is similar?
They used to, you know, brochures, pamphlets, just like we do today. The thing is, when we actually do a handout, we can also put it online, so it's globally accessible. But they did the same kind of thing, went and talked to their, you know, the parliamentarians. They found a parliament, you know, a parliamentarian who was their champion in the parliament. Same kinds of things that we did in the landmine campaign on the national levels. you know, to build the building blocks to make the campaign itself succeed. You think what really distinguishes the landmine campaign from others is that we got government so motivated that they were willing to reject traditional negotiating methods, which is, in my view, dictatorship by consensus. Because if, you know, 100 governments are in a room and 99 of them agree they're going to ban nuclear weapons and one says no, then the whole thing falls apart because you have to have consensus. In negotiating the landmine treaty, after it failed within the UN, after 2.5 years of trying, they stepped outside and they said, okay, we're not doing consensus. We're not negotiating in the UN. We're going to have standalone meetings in different parts of the world, and in that process, we're going to negotiate the treaty. Well, and that's what we did.
I know you started out in a, you know, probably a small office in Washington, D.C. There was you and there were a couple of the people from elsewhere. Do you think the success of cutting through all that stuff that normally one has to go through in the bureaucracy, which you're referring to now, came from, and I don't know this, and that's why I'm asking, it came from a grassroots movement working, succeeding mm-hmm. nationally, and that influenced the smaller and middle-sized mm-hmm. governments of nations around the world?
It really varied from country to country. You know, how When a non-governmental organization like Human Rights Watch or Save the Children or UNICEF or, you know, whatever around the world wanted to join the landmine campaign, all they had to do was agree with our basic call. And the basic call was a treaty banning landmines to make sure that governments give sufficient resources to get the mines out of the ground and to make sure they gave resources to help the landmine survivors. That was it. No dues, no nothing. We didn't tell them what to do. All we asked is that they do what they could do within their own mandate and let us know. Communicate, tell us what you're doing. That's all you have to do. And, of course, we, you know, there were some of us who were more involved on a daily basis and others who, you know, contributed when they can, could, and still can. And we would just formulate kind of every year a basic outline of things we would like to accomplish in that year. And then individual campaigns could work on those things that made sense for them. They could add their own flourish if it, you know, if things on the calendar didn't work for them. And it allowed this just incredible spontaneity and creativity and cross-fertilization among campaigns. The U.S. campaign, for example, was top-down. It was actually Senator Leahy and, you know, in the U.S. Senate who passed, got legislation passed, which was the first in the world to stop the export of landmines back in 1992. He hoped that, you know, his example would be taken up by the Clinton administration and become administration policy. So we didn't have in the U.S. a massive grassroots campaign so that when Clinton started balking, you know, under military pressure, we didn't have the base that might have been able to keep him on track. In other countries, it was really different. I mean, in Cambodia, for example, the amputees, the monks, you know, marched through the villages and the streets. They went to the temples and they got like 500,000 signatures of Cambodians calling for a ban on landmines. I mean, it really varied from country to country. But all of it added up to, in, you know, the U.S. case, the Leahy legislation, which then the French campaign took and challenged the French government to meet. But it was done in different ways in each country. And all they had to do was send me an email or a fax and let me know how what they'd done and how they'd done it, so I could then inform all of the campaign. Information, as we know, is power. And I wanted to make sure, honestly, that everybody in the campaign had the same power. You know, what if I kept all the information and so that everything had to go through me, how could that possibly make an international campaign work?
So what would you say was a very important thing that you learned in the building of the campaign?
Oh, in all honesty, a couple of things. That really, in a global campaign like that, it is the work of the many that really allow the dedicated vision of a few to get the job done. I don't know if that sound, if I said that in a way that's comprehensible. But the reality of it is that even in peace movements and NGOs, which are supposed to be more righteous than governments or whatever, there are a lot of blowhards who want to yap and don't really want to do the work. They want to tell you what should be done, but then they don't want to do anything. And in our campaign, you know, tons of people were really involved, but there were a handful of us who worked every single day to make sure that all of that was translated into a coherent global strategy that resulted in the mine ban treaty. Another thing that I believe in is communication, 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 and more communication. If you don't talk amongst all of the elements of what, you know, your NGO or your campaign or whatever, you're diminishing the effectiveness of each and every one of them. Another thing is follow-up. If you tell a government you're going to do X, if they do Y, make damn sure you do X. Because they may not like you, but they trust you if they know that you will always do what you say you're going to do. Whether it's praise them if they join the ban or condemn them or whatever, they know what the consequences are. And that builds trust and respect, even if they don't like you. I think those two things are particularly important.
In terms of advice or words of wisdom for folks who are listening to this, in terms of what they can do, not necessarily for the campaign, but just that whole thing of...
thinking about change.
And sure. Yes, engaging in
look,
change.
Look, one of the things that I do that drove the my colleagues in Landmine Campaign crazy when I would speak, when people would say, what can we do? My answer would not be join the campaign. My answer would be, I don't care what you do. I care that you care about something enough to do something about it, whether it's the environment, whether it's stopping nukes, whether it's cluster bombs, whether it's gender equality. I don't care what it is. But if you really care, volunteer some time. You know, you don't have to be a full-time activist to make a difference. I think that part of what happens in today's world is we're purposefully overwhelmed with all the, you know, gross things out there in the hope of turning us into Stepford citizens, automatons who think that we cannot make a difference in the world. So why bother? I totally disagree with that. Imagine if everybody of goodwill in this country volunteered 1 hour a month at some organization working on something they care about, whether it's community, it doesn't have to be international. All of it adds up to a different world. It doesn't take great drama to bring about change. All it means is getting up off your butt, finding an organization that's working on something you care about, and volunteer.
1997 Nobel Peace Prize winner Jody Williams talking with Carol Boss. Links to more information about Jody Williams and her work with the international campaign to ban landmines can be found at our website, peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com, where you can also hear this and other programs in our series again, read a partial transcript, order CDs, sign up for a podcast, or importantly, make a tax-deductible contribution to help keep this series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution on the air and on the web, all at peacetalksradio.com. We also have support from the Oppenheimer Brothers Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, and KUNM at the University of New Mexico. Music by Ali Adelman. Peace Talks Radio is a production of Good Radio Shows Incorporated. I'm Paul Ingalls. Thanks for listening.